This is a recording of the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission held on August 21st, 2008. Should you have questions after listening to this recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
I'm moving to the agenda. First item draft advisory opinion 2008-04, a request from Senator Dodd, and presenting is going to be Joanna Waldsteiger from the Office of General Counsel.
I'd like to move the late submitted document.
Okay, before we present, we're going to have a motion regarding late submitted documents.
Mr. Chairman, I would move to suspend the rules on timely submission of agenda documents in order to consider agenda document number 0819 and 0819A.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. I guess we could have done that one without objection, but that passes 6-0. Proceed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, Commissioners. The two alternative draft advisory opinions before you respond to a request submitted by counsel for Chris Dodd for President, Inc., the principal presidential campaign committee for Senator Christopher Dodd. During the course of Senator Dodd's presidential primary campaign, the committee accepted contributions designated for the general election, keeping them segregated from primary election contributions. Senator Dodd withdrew from the presidential race on January 3, 2008, and became a candidate for the U.S. Senate in 2010. In light of the fact that Senator Dodd accepted funds under the Matching Payment Act, the committee seeks permission to refund contributions designated for the general election or to obtain written redesignation of those contributions to Senator Dodd's senatorial campaign. The committee also seeks confirmation that the costs of refunding contributions and obtaining redesignations are considered winding down costs and may therefore be paid for with presidential primary election funds. Both draft advisory opinions conclude that the costs of refunding and obtaining redesignations of contributions are winding down costs and may be paid for with primary election funds. Both drafts also conclude that the committee may refund or obtain redesignations for contributions designated for the general election for up to 6 days after receipt of the advisory opinion. Agenda document 0819 emphasizes that this extension of the 60-day periods that the regulations permit to refund contributions or obtain redesignations is due only to the unprecedented and unforeseen circumstances at the time this advisory opinion was requested, the Commission's lack of quorum and consequent inability to respond to the request for several months. Draft B follows Advisory Opinion 1992-15 in concluding that the 60-day period begins to run on the date the candidate has actual notice of the need to refund contributions or obtain redesignations, and in granting the candidate the balance of the 60-day period that remained after submission of the advisory opinion request because of the novel legal questions posed. We received no comments on the advisory opinion request or on either draft. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have on either draft. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions or comments from the commissioners? Commissioner Hunter.
Mr. Chairman, with respect to draft B, as noted by the council, this draft does allow the senator to refund or redesignate funds he received as a candidate for his party's presidential nomination, and it allows him 6 days after receipt of this opinion to do so, relying on the commission's precedent set in Advisory Opinion 1992-15, the Russo Advisory Opinion, in that the question presented before the commission in the opinion in draft B is a novel question because Senator Dodd was the first candidate, as far as we know, to accept public primary funds in the primary presidential election and receive general election funds for the general election and to have lost them. So at this point, and to have lost the election, at this point, we allow the candidate to use those funds raised while he was a primary candidate to redesignate them to his senatorial campaign despite the restriction on post-ineligibility spending in 11 CFR 9034.4B3. Thank you.
Any have a few comments, then I'm looking to see if anyone else wants to speak. But essentially, we have two drafts before us, as I see it, that reach the same result but get there different ways. And I think there is a tension in the regs between the matching fund regime of the primary that Senator Dodd availed himself of and the ability to transfer money that he raised for the general election over to a different election. Without the matching fund regime, I think it's a very easy question. Obviously, he could do that so long as he complies with commission regs. But there is, I think, a unique question presented because of an evolution in the law. There's an advisory opinion that was actually issued to Senator Obama regarding the ability to raise general election money, yet not forego the opportunity to partake in the public financing with the general. I think that was an opinion correctly decided. And because of that, there are going to be additional questions which arise, and this is one of them. The real question, though, is I think we all agree how that he can do it. Just question is when. One draft gets there because the commission was shut down for 6 months, and thus the Dodd campaign could not get an answer. The other cites a prior advisory opinion. I'm more inclined to support that draft. I just find that draft more persuasive. But we both drafts get to the same place. So this is, in many ways, maybe just an illustration of how different commissioners will approach issues, but yet how, hopefully, the commission still comes out on the same result after having gotten there different ways. Any other comments, thoughts, concerns from the commissioners? Do we have a motion? Commissioner Hunter?
Mr. Chairman, I move to adopt agenda document number, advisory opinion 2008-04, draft B.
Motion is on draft B. All in favor of draft B say aye.
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 All opposed?
Nay.
That fails 3-3, the three being Commissioners Hunter, Peterson, and myself, McGann, and then Vice Chair Walther, Commissioners Bowerly and Weintraub voting in opposition. Another motion?
Mr. Chairman, I'd move adoption of agenda document A, which is agenda document number 0819, which is, I believe we're considering it, that to be draft A.
Motion is on draft A. All in favor? Say
aye.
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 All opposed? No.
No.
Draft A fails 3-3. The opposite vote. Commissioners Weintraub, Bowerly, Walther voting in favor, the remainder voting in opposition.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I'd move that we instruct our council to, since we all agree on the outcome, but we have differing points of view on how to get there, that we instruct council to return to us with a draft that basically points out that under the circumstances, we agree to the request as indicated in both drafts, but that we delete the portions that for which we have conflicting views.
On that motion, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? 6-0. Unanimous vote on the result. Question from the council.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. One question. We note that our time period to respond to Senator Dodd is September 2nd.
Okay.
So it wasn't clear to me. Is the commission's preference that we return this as a tally vote document?
I would suggest the quickest way we can do it, which would be tally vote.
Okay.
I envision it as saying the question and then yes, and then much shorter than the drafts, I would imagine. So yes, sooner the better.
Okay.
Thank you. Next item, advisory opinion request from the Democratic Party of Virginia. General Counsel's office, we're going to have David Atkins and Johnny Levin. Before we present, the Vice Chair has a motion.
Mr. Chairman, excuse me, I move to suspend the rules on the timely submission of agenda documents 0821 and 0821A in connection with this matter.
All in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? 6-0. Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and good morning to the other commissioners. The two alternative draft advisory opinions before you, agenda document 0821, which I'll refer to as draft A, and agenda document 08-21A, which I'll refer to as draft B, respond to an advisory opinion request submitted by counsel for the Democratic Party of Virginia. The Democratic Party of Virginia is a state party committee that is registered with the commission as a political committee. In connection with the 2008 general election, the committee plans to prepare and distribute publications featuring the party's candidates who are running for state or federal office in the state of Virginia. These publications will include information about the election, as well as abstract designs, images, and candidate photos. Both committee employees and volunteers will distribute these publications by mail and by hand, and will be encouraged to converse with recipients of the publications. The committee asks two questions. First, whether its publications qualify as exempt from the definitions of contribution and expenditure, and second, if so, whether there exists any restrictions on the manner in which the committee's volunteers or employees may distribute the publications. With respect to each of the committee's questions, both drafts A and B analyze separately publications distributed by volunteers and publications distributed by committee employees. For publications distributed by volunteers, both drafts A and B conclude with respect to question one that the publications will qualify as exempt under the volunteer activity exemption. With respect to question two, both drafts conclude that the manner in which volunteers may distribute publications under the volunteer activity exemption is unrestricted. For publications distributed by committee employees, both drafts A and B reach different conclusions on both questions one and two. On question one, draft B concludes that publications distributed by committee employees that use candidate photographs in the supplementary manner proposed by the requester qualify for the slate card exemption. Draft A concludes they do not. On question two, draft B concludes that the slate card exemption does not restrict the manner in which committee employees may distribute the publications. Alternatively, draft A concludes that under the slate card exemption, committee employees must limit the verbal message delivered with the slate card in order for the distribution costs to be exempt. Draft A makes clear, however, that nothing said by a committee employee during distribution will remove the costs associated with the production of that publication under the exemption. We received two comments on these drafts, and I'm happy to address any questions or comments you may have. Thank you.
Questions by the commission? No comments. Well, then I will go. I am in favor of draft. Make sure I get the right draft here in front of me. Draft B, sorry. Draft A, and I note that we received some late comments on this. The comments have come from the requester, filed through council, the Virginia Democratic Party, and also comments from the Democratic National Committee, also submitted through council, both of whom support draft B, the draft I support. And I share the analysis and the thoughts that they have on this with respect to draft A. I think draft A is unnecessarily restrictive and produces probably some unintended consequences with respect to how party programs operate in the country for both party committees. And for those who are not a member of either party committee, their own party committee. I don't want to necessarily say there's only two parties. But regardless of one's party affiliation, I think the notion of doing retail politics as it was formally understood, I think, is very important. I think those who passed the Federal Election Campaign Act in the 70s did not want to limit that, although apparently it had some limits, so they had to amend the law in the late 70s, a few years later, to try to restore some of the grassroots politics. The so-called slate card exemption is one of those. And all it really says is you can print up slate cards that it does not count against any sort of spending limit. It does not, would not be a contribution to those candidates. The slate cards have been handed out since then. The Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act was passed, and before the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act was passed, and after the Bipartisan Campaign Act was passed, slate cards were handed out, and people said whatever they wanted to say in handing out the slate card. BICRA, as it's called, did not change that. What it did change, perhaps, is how you pay for it, because it's introduced the concept of federal election activity. So therefore, what we're looking at today, particularly this request, given that it is Virginia, where they don't have non-federal elections in the federal election years, you're looking at all hard money. So you're looking at an all hard money party program that would allow for folks to go door to door. The real trouble I have with draft A is how it limits what you can and cannot say in handing out slate cards. The comment from the requester states, you could only imagine, it essentially says, you can only imagine how this would work. They said, I'd love to help you be a better informed voter, but that could take 2 minutes, and they do not have any 44-1AD authority with me today, so sorry, please don't ask me any additional questions. So you're really limited to saying what's only on the slate card, and you can't go beyond the slate card. If you do, draft A, in fairness, does not prevent you from saying that. It just imposes additional restrictions and burdens on how you pay for it, and I would suggest that's going to be unworkable to the point where it'll kill off the whole point of the slate card exception. Very few folks really do a lot of slate cards anymore because they look kind of dated. And I like the idea of allowing for a little bit more flair on the slate cards, a little more eye-catching. To me, slate cards depend on the content, not the pictures. However, if a picture conveys some content, I think that could run afoul of the slate card exception. But the real gist of the issue is really, to me, how party committees do their get-out-the-vote operations. And the real choice for me is whether or not we're going to encourage door-to-door politics where people paid for by a party committee can go and actually talk to people one-on-one and hand out some literature and say, here's the slate I believe in, please go vote for them on election day, or are we going to continue to push the money from that sort of program into independent expenditures and robocalls and that kind of thing. The reality is the kind of money that you're going to spend on these programs is not that much compared to the millions and millions of dollars spent on TV. And it seems to me if someone spends, a party committee spends $50,000 on printing and door-to-door, I would rather have them do that than spend $50,000 on robocalls. The money is going to be spent regardless, so I think the agency ought to encourage the right kind of spending. To me, draft B is wholly consistent with the statute. The statute itself says the cost of distribution is included in the slate card exemption, so if you are distributing a slate card, that cost comes under the slate card exemption and thus not subject to a spending limit. My final point is folks who work for parties who distribute things door-to-door tend not to work in K Street law firms or Wall Street brokerage houses or that sort of thing. It is not as easy as it sounds to describe to people what they can and cannot say in context of elections. If one looks at recent Supreme Court cases on what is express advocacy, one can see that very intelligent people can disagree on where the lines are. And when you get into retail politics, particularly in more urban areas, it's very difficult to explain abstract legal concepts to folks that really don't make a lot of sense unless you have a very detailed understanding of federal election law. And I can only imagine trying to explain to people, you're being paid today to deliver these slate cards, and you're being paid up front to deliver the slate cards, because if you're working kind of as a day worker, that's how it works. But if you say the wrong thing, you're going to have to come back to us because we're going to have to pay you a different kind of money. It's very troubling to me. To me, it should be much easier for parties to operate in the retail political level, and I am confident that those who sponsored, at least on the House side, and voted for Shays Meehan, which became BICRA, one of their goals was to return politics more to the traditional grassroots, not the more innovative, independent of campaign-type spending. So with that, I'm in favor of draft P. Any other comments? Do we have a motion?
Let me just point out a little bit on that. In a couple of areas, I certainly disagree with the chairman on a number of issues. But for me, the slate card exemption is simply that. It's a slate card, and it is for the purpose of identifying for a voter who's on the slate and a little bit of information. But it's not to be a promotional piece, it's not to be a sales piece, it's to be an informational piece. And my concern is not, I have no problem with embellishing it with graphics and that kind of thing, I think that's great. That's a neutral message, but when you run the risk of then taking photographs, like we've said in the past, excessive biography information, and it becomes more of a promotional piece. And I think we find ourselves in the slippery slope of trying to sliver off different ways in which to characterize things, and we find ourselves making it more difficult than it needs to be in order to accomplish the objective of advising the people who is on that slate and a little bit of information about them. If we want to go beyond that, then of course that can be done, but it seems to me that when we're getting beyond what the original intent of it was, and it also puts us in the situation of where it's hard for us to draw those kind of lines. If we were to perhaps if we get to the point of talking about language, we can tighten that up some way, but we're not there at the moment. There's some other issues of difference as well.
Mr. Ballard.
Thank you. With respect to draft B, I agree that with the approach it takes on with respect to the content of the slate cards. I agree that once photos get into t-shirts that have slogans or other sort of messages, that may pull those photographs and then the slate card out from the exemption, but until it reaches that point, in my view, additional photographs are not problematic with respect to the content piece. I think where we have some disagreement, as I understand it, is with respect to the view of how committee employees distribute and what, in my view, committee employees can say whatever they like when they are distributing those. But we have lots of other provisions in the Act and in our regulations which at times require allocation between different pots of money, not necessarily which pots of money someone may be paid with, but whether that must be considered a contribution, perhaps. I don't think we have to get into the nuances of it, but my concern about the approach in draft B is that it seems to throw the door a little too wide open for me. I don't believe a slate card should become a get out of all regulation free card. I think that the distribution costs with the slate card are exempt. The production costs are clearly exempt. But for example, if someone were distributing 10 items, one of which is a slate card, it seems to me that slate card exemption can't swallow the cost for the exemption as a whole, and that's my concern. And I do think that draft A states that existing regulations and other provisions of the Act may still apply to this activity, and to that extent that they've been implemented by party committees, I think they could still accomplish that. Thank you.
Mr. Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wasn't really happy with either of the drafts. It seemed to me that neither one of them was really perfect. Like Commissioner Bowerly, I prefer draft B on the content. I'm not worried about pictures of the Shenandoah Mountains or Skyline Drive or Virginia Beach, although were I to vote for this, I would ask for one amendment. There's a phrase in there that talks about photographs of diverse groups of fresh-faced Virginians, and I don't actually know what that means. And I think perhaps we should take that phrase out of there. I gather that came from a conversation that was held between our staff and the requester. And
I believe that did come from the requester. I'm not sure I understand what it is either, but in my view, it's not inconsistent with the statutory limitations on the slate card. So even if they're fresh-faced or poker-faced or sour-faced or old-faced or new-faced or ugly-faced or good-looking-faced, it does not change the fact that the slate card would still be a slate card.
Don't argue with me too much, Mr. Chairman, because I just might agree with you.
I wasn't arguing. I was just attempting to clarify and assist you in your thinking.
I think that Commissioner Bowerly also raises a good point about, you know, distributing a whole lot of materials and you've got a slate card in there, and therefore, you know, you believe that you put yourself in a whole different category. I'm going to make a leap of faith here and assume that that's not actually what the requester is talking about. Were I to discover that that's what the requester was talking about, I would have a different view of it. But if all we're talking about is walking around handing out slate cards, I think it probably is just unworkable to try and limit too much what people are saying as they're walking around and handing these things out. So since I don't actually like to impose rules that don't make sense and aren't workable in practice, while I'm not 100% comfortable, as I said, with either draft, I would be willing to support draft B if you'll take out fresh-faced. How about that? How's that for a deal, Mr. Chairman?
Well, let me think about that. I hadn't anticipated fresh face. But the commissioner does raise a very good point. The request asks a narrow question. It does not ask the question as to what if you hand out a slate card and a bunch of other stuff. It asks the question, what if you hand out a slate card? What can you say handing out the slate card? So to me, I could see a separate issue. Not sure I would change my result, but I could certainly acknowledge there's a separate issue with respect to what if you do something else in addition to handing out slate cards. But the request asked the question, what about handing out slate cards, not what about handing out all kinds of pieces or what if we have to allocate or any of that other stuff. It's a very narrow question. On draft B, Commissioner, I need to ask you a question. Where is the – oh, here it is.
It's on page 2, line 7.
I see it. Yes, here. Let's see. This is what the requester wants to add. They want to add an American flag. We're in favor of the American flag is okay, right? Okay.
Absolutely.
Scenery from the Commonwealth of Virginia. You mentioned that, Skyline Drive. Okay. Photographs of diverse groups of fresh-faced Virginians. I'm in favor of photographs of a group of fresh-faced Virginians. So if it's okay, I'd actually ask if there's a motion on the draft as is, see how that goes, and if that fails, then we're happy to consider the amendment and cross out fresh-faced and vote on that.
See, what I'm thinking about, Mr. Chairman, is that I know my mother's watching us on C-SPAN right now, and she's a Marylander, so she wouldn't be covered by this in any event. But I would hate to think that somebody would tell her that she couldn't be in the picture because she's, you know, a little bit older than perhaps some of the commissioners at the table today.
Oh, so you just wish to strike fresh-faced in quotes, not the concept of people with pictures.
No. Just that term. I want to make sure it truly is a diverse group of Virginians.
Okay, I think you're right. That makes some sense. I just took the requester's request on face value. So if we want to, if we have a motion on draft B as amended by striking the fresh-faced, in quotes, on page 2, line 7, do we have a motion?
So moved.
Thank you. Motion on draft B as amended. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed say no.
No.
That carries 4-2 with Commissioners Hunter, Peterson, McGann, and Weintraub voting in favor, and Commissioners Bowerly and Walter voting in opposition. Take it we can move to the next item on the agenda and all these other drafts and notes that I had we can now put away. Next item, draft, is an advisory opinion request from Senator David Vitter. General Counsel's Office, we're going to have Jessica Selenkoff presenting. Does I understand it? Yes. How are you? Before you present, the Vice Chair would like to make a motion regarding the various agenda documents.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move to suspend the rules on the timely submission of agenda documents in order to consider agenda document 0820 on this matter.
Motion is pending. I was not listening. I apologize, Mr. Vice Chair. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed. Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Take it away.
Good morning, Commissioners. The two alternative draft advisory opinions before you respond to a request by Senator David Vitter and his principal campaign committee, David Vitter for U.S. Senate. Senator Vitter incurred over $200,000 in legal fees in connection with a criminal proceeding against a third party, Ms. Deborah Palfrey. The legal fees were incurred in monitoring the Palfrey proceeding, quashing subpoenas in the Palfrey proceeding, consulting on press relations, and assisting separate counsel who represented Senator Vitter before the Senate Ethics Committee. Senator Vitter has already paid approximately $70,000 of these legal fees. Senator Vitter and the committee ask whether the committee may use campaign funds to pay or reimburse Senator Vitter for these legal fees. Agenda document number 820 concludes that the committee's payment of or reimbursement for legal fees for press relations and consultations with the Ethics Council would not be a conversion to personal use, because these legal fees would not exist irrespective of Senator Vitter's campaign or duties as a U.S. Senator, but that the committee's payment of or reimbursement for legal fees for quashing the subpoenas and monitoring the Palfrey proceeding would constitute personal use under the Act and Commission regulations. Agenda Document 820A concludes that the committee may pay or reimburse Senator Vitter for all legal fees in connection with the Palfrey proceeding, because none of the legal fees would exist irrespective of Senator Vitter's campaign or duties as a U.S. Senator. We have received one comment from Senator Vitter on the alternate drafts. I'm available for any questions you have. Thank you.
Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Since Commissioner Weintraub invoked her mother earlier, I will do the same with mine, who my mother, while I was growing up, would always tell me to emphasize the positives. So let me start off by emphasizing where I believe all six of the commissioners stand. It appears that we all agree that with respect to legal expenses that are incurred as a result of dealing with an ethics committee investigation or dealing with press relations communication strategy, that we agree that campaign funds may be used in those circumstances. It's on the other areas where we may have some disagreement. So let me at least start with where we agree before we go where we may be disagreeing. Determining the scope of the what is a permissible use of campaign funds, what's personal use, what's not, is, as I was going through these cases, I didn't find it to be a particularly easy exercise. It's a very fact-intensive undertaking, and as a result, the commission has typically taken a case-by-case approach, and I think that that recognizes the reality that it's hard to draw easily definable lines and then put certain items within those parameters. I found that what sounds simple in theory is oftentimes more difficult in practice. And as in this particular case, as General Counsel's office has pointed out, we have four boxes that we've formed. Basically, one for the ethics investigation, one for dealing with the press, one for monitoring a criminal case, and one for quashing the subpoenas. And then we kind of make determinations with what items go within each box and how much or of one's campaign funds can be used to, can be spent to offset legal expenses and which how much can't. As I was going through this case, I went back and forth on a number of times as to what rule we should actually apply. As I was going through the precedents, I thought they provided a lot of guidance too. There were some unique facts in this current case that didn't fit neatly with some of the others. But one thing that stood out to me is as we were applying the irrespective test, which again can be a somewhat difficult test to apply, one thing that made the decision a little bit easier in this case was the fact that the defendant in the underlying criminal case, which the defendant which subpoenaed the requester in this case, in essence announced what her strategy was. She was going to drag into, as part of her defense strategy, was going to subpoena high-profile names who were on a list of over 15,000 individuals that were on phone lists that were disclosed. And basically, the higher the profile of the public figure, the more likely they were going to be brought in. 14,996 folks didn't have to worry. Excuse me, 14,994 were off the hook. Six were brought in, and the defendant in that case made it very clear the reasons why she was bringing in certain of those individuals. And I thought it was also interesting that, with respect to the requester, the subpoenas were issued, but there was never any requirement that person testify, which again indicates that this really was part of a defense strategy, and that they were targeted not in terms of their value really for as a witness, but really in terms of bringing in someone who was high profile. And this was acknowledged openly in the press, and for me that was a a rather compelling fact. I know that there's unlikely going to be an agreement on this issue. I know that that three of my colleagues believe that the cost for monitoring, for example, monitoring the criminal case, that those should not be, that the costs that were incurred with respect to that should not be paid for out of campaign funds, because it is their opinion, and an opinion I respect, that that would have happened irrespective of whether or not the requester was a senator. I have, in my own mind, I find that difficult to believe. I really don't believe that the other 14,994 individuals who were on those phone logs retained separate counsel to monitor that criminal case. I think that the reason why Requester was brought in and subpoenaed was because of his status as a public official, and he needed to maintain criminal counsel as a result, because of his status as a public official. In these cases, there's sometimes a temptation, I think, to and I'm speaking as myself, I don't attribute this to any of my colleagues, to sometimes maybe take a peek into what the underlying offense may have been and then determine, is this guy a good guy or is this guy a bad guy, and let's make the determination along those lines. And I guess that will always be a temptation in all of these cases that we address. But I also think that in many of these matters, no charges are actually brought against the requesters, and that temptation always needs to be withstood. And again, I'm speaking for myself, not for anyone else. I am concerned that when individuals decide to run for public office, that they become a target, and legal actions can be lodged against them. They may not be precisely, the underlying action may not deal precisely with campaign or official duties, but they're being targeted because of their official status. And I'm worried about making congressmen, senators, making them human shields for indicted criminal defendants. And so again, in this case, the requester was never an indication that he was a target. So really, the monitoring that he was doing with respect to the underlying criminal case was really to help him out in an ethics investigation, which was going on, an ethics investigation, which all six of us agree is a proper form where the requester may use campaign funds to offset legal expenses. In past precedents, we have acknowledged that that as public officials, there is a political necessity to respond to allegations, even if the underlying allegation doesn't relate to campaign or official duties, and that there is a heightened scrutiny that goes along with being a public official. And so, in this case, really where the requester was at greatest risk was with respect to an ethics investigation. There was a complaint that was filed before the ethics committee, and as a result, he had to monitor the criminal case, because what was going on in that criminal case was forming the basis for what the complaint before the ethics committee, what they were considering. So in this case, I'm going to support draft B, which would permit the requester to offset all of his legal expenses with campaign funds, because I believe that none of them would have arisen but for the fact that he was a public official.
Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I also appreciate that there are areas of agreement here, which is always a good thing, but there are also areas of disagreement. I don't think this is about whether the senator is a good guy or a bad guy. I think what we're being asked to decide is, were certain expenses, did they result from campaign or officeholder activities? Would they have existed irrespective of the candidate's campaign or duties as a federal officeholder? I think pretty plainly the expenses at issue resulted from pretty unofficial activities. And the commission has in recent years taken a hard look at what the legal expenses pertain to and has not given a blank check to members of Congress that just because they have campaign funds, they can use them to cover all of their legal expenses. Yes, members of Congress do have heightened scrutiny, If a member of Congress were in a messy divorce, then that would make the papers, and it would be embarrassing. But I don't think we would say that he could use campaign funds to hire the best divorce lawyer in town so that he came out looking better in his divorce trial. If a member of Congress held real estate and the tenants said, we want you to fix the plumbing, and we're going to pick it in front of your Senate office and embarrass you if you don't do something about it, he couldn't take his campaign funds and hire a plumber to fix the plumber in his real estate as a landlord. And I think that the expenses of monitoring a criminal trial, and these arising out of these kinds of activities, and quashing a subpoena that was levied against him, are essentially personal activities. And there were, I believe, other men around town who were lawyering up when all this hit the newspapers. He wasn't the only guy in town who was nervous. Undoubtedly, not all 14,000 hired lawyers, but I bet some of them did, people who were prominent in other areas of life who were afraid that they might get drawn in. And I bet a lot of people were watching that trial pretty darn closely. It's a fact of life that members of Congress do get heightened scrutiny, and some of them like the publicity that they get in other contexts, and sometimes you get some bad publicity. It is not the case that there's no such thing as bad publicity. There certainly is. We've seen over the years various senators have to deal with that. But these were, in my view, not expenses that resulted from campaign or officeholder activities in any way. And I believe he still would have had them. And it would have been irresponsible. He did hire, even the senator concedes there were certain activities of his criminal defense lawyer that would not be covered by his campaign funds. And, you know, I think it would have been irresponsible for that lawyer not to be monitoring the trial and not to be seeking to quash that subpoena. When you have a subpoena levied against you, you got to do something about it. So I support document 08-20, which I guess is draft A in our parlance. I think it reaches the right result. I think it allows the senator, consistent with previous practice, to use campaign funds to when there are ethics charges levied against him at the Senate Ethics Committee, because those are only charges that are levied against him because he is a senator. Otherwise, they wouldn't have jurisdiction over him. So we're not saying he can't use any campaign funds at all. What draft A says is that he just can't use campaign funds for all of his legal expenses pertaining to this matter.
Mr. Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I support draft A for the same reasons as Commissioner Weintraub. Just to add to that, the statute is clear to me that you either look at two really factors here: a candidate's election campaign or the individual's duties as an office holder. Now, I grant you that after the adoption of that statute, it's gravitated to the point where you can look at the person's status. But that's really not in the statute. It's not in the regs. It is something we recognize, but I'm not personally inclined to expand that. When it involves trying to fight a subpoena for a lawful proceeding in a criminal matter, and at that particular point, a judgment has to be made. Do I want to be a witness or do I not? And I don't think it's our call to have campaign funds be used for that purpose. The conduct did not arise. It may be different if the criminal matter involves something that related to the duties of the campaign, but it did not. So then you have to look at, well, why are we doing this? And I can't think of a reason why we would want to expand the interpretation for that. It also applies to monitoring a criminal trial. That is an election that someone makes because they're undoubtedly concerned about what might be said. But I don't think that's a basis for us to, especially in a case like this where the individual is not involved in the trial as a defendant, so to have someone sit and monitor a trial of another person for a criminal event does not seem to me to be a sensible way to embellish upon the use of the word status, and that's really what we're talking about here. It's not duties, let's face it. It's not campaign activity, let's face it. It's the status link that's been expanded upon in some of our AOs since the adoption of the statute. And to me, it would be an expansion that doesn't make much sense, and it's outside the intent of what was the law really, I think, intended.
Mr. Peterson.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to make one response to Vice Chairman Walther. I think if this were a matter of first impression, I may very well see things like you do. As I was studying through this issue, when you start with the statute and then look at the context in which the agency has interpreted that statute, it's had occasion on a number of occasions to analyze this text in the advisory opinion context. And there are a number of advisory opinions: the Hilliard advisory opinion, the Cooley advisory opinion, the Costello advisory opinion, which I think are consistent and support the finding, the approach that we are looking at in draft B. I acknowledge that there are some more recent advisory opinions which appear to be taking a bit of a different course, but as I was looking at those advisory opinions, they both involved individuals who got everything they asked for because it was found that everything related close enough to a campaign or official duty. And then there would be kind of a boilerplate sentence saying, but if something didn't apply to, if you incur legal expenses that aren't related to campaign or official duties, then you may not use campaign funds. but really, that statement was not applied to the facts in those cases. When we've actually applied the irrespective test to the facts, I think that we have had that those approaches in the Hilliard, Cooley, and others support the approach that's being taken in draft B, and it's for that reason that I'm supporting draft B.
Mr. Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't want to prolong this needlessly, but I actually think that's not entirely right. I think there have been instances in more recent years when we have said you can't use campaign funds to cover certain legal expenses because they're not closely enough related to office holder and campaign activities.
If I could jump in, where to begin? Much of what Commissioner Weintraub said is absolutely correct. If someone has to pay for a lawyer because they have a personal property dispute because they're a landlord, they can't use campaign funds for that, even though the newspapers show up and want to cover it necessarily. They get in a messy divorce, it's probably the same. If they're a criminal defendant in a drunk driving case, I don't think the commission allows use of campaign funds for that. However, that's not the case that we have here before us. This is not a situation where the requester was a defendant or a party to a civil suit. He was a witness, and a witness that was, and the reason why he was a witness is because of, I think, a very compelling set of facts presented by the requester, that the person who was the defendant in the case certainly had a strategy of pulling in high-profile people to try to get headlines. It certainly occurred. There's a volume of news articles which muddy the facts even further as to what was really happening, as to how many people were actually subpoenaed and that kind of thing. I don't think any of those factual distinctions are material for the real question before the commission. But I think that really the case couldn't be more compelling. If it were a case of first impression, however, I think that as always, the vice chair's comments are thoughtful, well-reasoned, and are also wholly consistent with the statutory text as written. But this is not a case of first impression. The commission has had many years and many advisory opinions on this matter, and I believe that draft B is wholly consistent with the commission's past rulings. And in fact, the commission's past rulings really lead to only one result, and that is the result in draft B. Draft B cites the Cooley AO from 1996, which states, quote, "The commission recognized that the activities of candidates and office holders may receive heightened scrutiny and attention because of their status as candidates and office holders. The obvious need for a candidate to respond to allegations that result from this elevated scrutiny would not exist irrespective of the candidate's campaign or office holder status." I'm very hesitant to essentially undo what the commission has already done. After all, advisory opinions are one of the few ways folks can get guidance from the commission and then rely upon it. The statute is clear on this point. Once an advisory opinion is issued, that requester can rely on it. And anyone who operates under that advisory opinion and on factual matters, indistinguishable in any sort of material respect, can rely upon that AO. The alternative, the draft A, however, overrules, as I read it, past commission advisory opinions. That's very troubling, because I think people have probably relied on those advisory opinions, and I see that the request currently before us obviously is headed the same direction, particularly with respect to the idea of monitoring a criminal proceeding. Looking at draft A, page 12, at the top there, it explicitly says, thus, this advisory opinion supersedes, in part, advisory opinion 9712, Costello, to the extent the opinion permitted the use of campaign funds to pay for a portion of legal expenses resulting from monitoring a third party's criminal trial. So to get to the result that draft A gets requires undoing what has already been done, and that's something I'm hesitant to do. Again, these are very tough questions. It seems to me somewhat counterintuitive that one could pay a lawyer to defend one from an accusation of bribery, but not necessarily use campaign funds to pay for a situation where they're a witness in a trial. So for that reason, I support draft B. Senator Vitter himself actually submitted a comment personally. He did not do it through counsel, and very rare. And he really presents to me a very thoughtful approach. I disagree with one thing he does say at the end, though, where he says a tied vote will mean a complete lack of resolution in this case. I don't think it does. I think there's quite a bit of agreement on certain issues here. It's just a couple other issues where there's going to be disagreement. But in the case of a deadlock, the advisory opinions that are currently on the books would govern. So to the extent Senator Vitter can avail himself of the protections of those advisory opinions, there is guidance, and this would not result in him not having guidance. He could then use whatever advisory opinions still would be good law for comfort, and the statute mandates that result. So that we're clear what the statute says in that respect. Any person involved in any specific transaction or activity which is indistinguishable in all its material aspects — materiality is a very important concept — our material aspects from the transaction or activity with respect to which this advisory opinion is rendered may rely on this advisory opinion. This is it. This is in the statute, and that is what's in all advisory opinions now. And the site is 2 U.S.C. 437F C1B for those who are into sites. So to the extent someone is reviewing this after the fact, reads the transcript or whatnot, there shouldn't be any confusion as to what a deadlock may mean. It means whatever the current advisory opinion situation is remains the law of at least this commission and perhaps the law of the land. Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be interested to see. We haven't been working together that long. I'll be interested to see as we go forward if you maintain your attitude towards existing advisory opinions and how we must maintain them and not change anything that the commission has said in years gone by. I would just point out that
obviously if there's a statutory change that would change an advisory opinion, facts can change. Advisory opinions are conceitedly fact intensive, so it's certainly not a situation where it's a mechanical application of the law. But once an advisory opinion is rendered, I think it does have some effect, and I don't think we should willy-nilly disregard them to get to a certain result. And I think draft A does that.
Well, I take some exception to that characterization that anyone is trying to approach anything with a goal of getting to a certain result. Just as I take some exception to the characterization that, you know, we're motivated because we think an individual is engaged in bad acts. We're applying the law here. And the commission has, in more recent advisory opinions, diverged from the viewpoint of those older advisory opinions. So I think that the law on the books is considerably muddier than you've suggested. And I think that's why Mr. Vitter's excellent attorney submitted this advisory opinion request, because he didn't think it was absolutely clear. I noted that when we received the request, that he didn't ask whether he could use, whether the senator could use campaign funds in order to pay someone who is exclusively working on the ethics investigation. And I believe that's because that is undisputed, and the commission has never said anything to the contrary, and the question really didn't need to be asked. I don't want to speak for anybody who's sitting in the audience, but that was my assumption as to why that piece of it was not made part of the advisory opinion request. I do think that the interpretation of preceding precedents to the facts at issue, the specific facts at issue in Senator Vitter's request, are not nearly as clear-cut as you've suggested.
Do you agree, though, that draft A does supersede at least one past AO in some form?
In some form, but I believe that the more recent advisory opinions have already gone down that road.
Fair enough. My thought of why they asked, though, wasn't because they were uncertain as to the result. The reality is, I think the House Ethics Committee requires, and the Senate Committee certainly does, pre-approval for use of campaign funds for such things. I think they do have to come in. I don't think it's necessarily because the law was unclear. I think they came in because, for their own ethical obligations as a member of the Senate, they had to submit an opinion and see if they can get specific guidance to their situation. And my point is they are going to get some specific guidance on certain issues. Other issues they're not, and I'm suggesting under the statute they can then rely upon prior advisory opinions.
And I'm suggesting that reliance might be a bit risky.
That's why we have an advisory opinion process, so people can protect themselves in factual situations. It's a shield to protect people who are willing to come in and ask for advice, and the commission ought to see it as such.
And we do when we have four votes for an opinion. It works.
Well, but we don't need four votes to protect. Once the opinion's rendered, we don't need four votes to then keep it in place and protect that particular situation.
Well, this particular situation has not been presented to the commission before.
I disagree. Do we have a motion? Unless there are other comments. We have other comments. Sorry.
I'm ready to.
Okay. Do we have a motion?
With respect to advisory opinion 2008-07, I move that we adopt draft B.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed?
No.
Nay.
Motion fails 3-3 with Commissioners Hunter, Peterson, and McGann voting in favor, Commissioners Walther, Bowerly, and Weintraub voting in opposition. Any other motions? Mr. Vice Chair.
Mr. Chairman, I would move the adoption of Agenda Document 0820, which is referred to as Draft A.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. That motion fails 3-3. What I would, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move that we instruct counsel to prepare a document that would approve those for which we've indicated we have approval, namely the press relations and consultation, but that would point out that we were unable to give guidance on the issue of quashing subpoenas and monitoring, and to prepare that for our signature.
Does council have any questions on that motion?
One question, in preparing it for your signature, meaning you would not want to have it come around as a tally vote or anything, we would just drop out certain portions of it where there is not agreement, or would you want to see it again as a tally vote document? We can happily do it either way.
I would think tally vote, because there's areas of agreement, and we get those through, and then sooner the better, I would think. So we do tally vote and
okay.
Take a look at it that way. Does that work for the council?
Yes.
Wonderful. Next item on the agenda.
Wait a minute. Don't we need to vote on that?
We didn't vote on the motion. Sorry, I apologize. We didn't vote on the motion. I asked for the question before the vote this time. Thank you, Mr. Weintraub.
We do want to give him the guidance that we can give.
Yeah, we do. Right. That would be nice. After all this, and then, you know, just we forget to actually do anything. I apologize for that. All in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? 6-0. The motion passes. Next item on the agenda is a advisory opinion request from Senator Lautenberg. And presenting from the council is Joanna Waldsteiger, I believe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We also have Allison Steinle and Johnny Levin working on it. I think others, Johnny, yes.
Agenda document 08-18, response to an advisory opinion request submitted by counsel for Senator Frank Lautenberg and his principal campaign committee, Lautenberg for Senate. Senator Lautenberg loaned his campaign committee a total of $1.6 million toward his June 3, 2008 primary election. According to reports filed with the commission, these loans have not been repaid. On June 26, the Supreme Court issued its opinion in Davis v. Federal Election Commission, striking down two provisions of the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act as unconstitutional. These provisions concerned increased contribution and party spending limits and related disclosure requirements. Senator Lautenberg and his campaign committee ask whether, in light of the Davis decision, the commission will enforce against them the provision of BCRA placing certain limits on an authorized committee's repayment of a personal loan from the candidate. The draft before you concludes that the loan repayment provision was not addressed in Davis and that it is severable from the provisions that were struck down. Therefore, Senator Lautenberg and his campaign committee remain subject to the provision. We received one comment on the advisory opinion request. I'm happy to answer any questions you might have. Thank you.
Comments? It is what it is. Then I'll just say a few words to put a little context on this. It's an interesting request because it does make sense to make the request post FEC versus Davis, which struck down the millionaire provision. The court, however, there did not rule on this particular question regarding a candidate's ability to self-finance and whether or not that money would be considered a loan or a contribution, and ultimately whether it can be paid back to the candidate. The Supreme Court in McConnell upheld it on its face, and the Supreme Court has not addressed the issue since, nor has any other federal court. And thus, I feel that we are bound as we should be bound by the statute. We did receive one comment from Campaign Legal Center and Democracy 21. I thought they were very helpful, and I thought they were right on the money with the need to read the statute as is and not essentially do a backdoor constitutional challenge. Regardless of what one may think of the constitutionality, this is not the format for that. The requester did make an interesting argument that did cause me some pause, which is the way the law was passed out of the Senate and House was a little bit different than how it was codified in the book. It was much more compressed into one section. However, I think the law is somewhat clear that we as an agency can still sever out the portion that remains. There is a severability clause that was in the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act that was actually something subject to vigorous debate in the House for probably precisely these situations where a portion would be maybe perhaps struck down, but then the rest would still live on. So in my view, it does live on. I do want to note that this is a very quick request that has come through. I asked the council, do we recall when this was actually submitted? It was late July.
It was July 25th.
July 25th. I think it made it upstairs maybe the first week of August, and here we are a few weeks later, and that really is a tribute to in reverse order, really, my fellow commissioners. I really appreciate them indulging me and trying to move things through quickly. But actually, this was one that I think others came to me and said, can we move this through quickly, particularly the vice chair, Commissioner Bowerly and Commissioner Weintraub, seeing if I would be interested in moving this sort of request quickly. And we are. And I really want to thank the staff on this. The council's office really went beyond the call of duty to circulate a very quick draft. And we really appreciate you willing to indulge us in what has been a very tough time for you, I'm sure, because many things have changed. The commission was shut down for 6 months, essentially, and did what it could. But given that you need four votes and at least four voting commissioners to even have a meeting, not much occurred. And we just really want to thank you for moving this along. I think it's important to get people real advice in real time. So with that overblown speech, is there a motion on the one draft that we have in front of us?
Mr. Chairman, I would move that we adopt the draft before us, draft AO 2008-07. Oops, sorry about that. 2008-09, pardon me.
On in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion passes 6-0. Thank you. I'd like to take a 5-minute recess.